In my personal opinion, one of the most interesting structures that can be found in all of Middle Tennessee is the Parthenon in Nashville. Now, the Parthenon is a replica of the Great Parthenon, which is found in Athens, Greece. And as replicas go, the one here in Nashville is probably the best of all the lot. Now, the original Parthenon in Athens was built 2,500 years ago. It was built as a temple to the goddess Athena, and it was placed on a hill which overlooked the city, a hill they called the Acropolis. I have climbed that hill and have seen that Parthenon. I was there 2 years ago with my family. And I can say that in Middle Tennessee, we've got the better Parthenon. One, you don't have to climb a hill to see it, and two, it's not broken like theirs is. The Parthenon in Nashville was built in 1897 as part of the celebration of the Tennessee Centennial, 100 years that Tennessee became a state. If you know your Tennessee history, 1897 is the wrong year. It's supposed to have been the year before, but the centennial celebration got delayed due to lack of funding and construction delays. But anyway, they pulled it together the next year and had a six-month exhibition there in the area now known as Centennial Park in Nashville. And at the center was this Parthenon, which they built to recognize Nashville as what? There you go. Athens of the South. Thank you. As a side note, Memphis also had an entry in the centennial. They built a huge pyramid right next to the Parthenon, and these were lit up, outlined with electric lights at night, and it was supposedly spectacular. But anyway, the centennial celebration went on for 6 months, and it went extremely well. They even made a profit. And when it came time for it to be over, they tore down all the buildings, except for the Parthenon, because people of Tennessee had fallen in love with this building. However, it was only a temporary structure. It was never meant to last. So by 1920, it was in great disrepair. So they essentially rebuilt it with more durable materials like concrete. And so there it is 100 years later, stands there and doing quite well. Now, this Parthenon is not the only replica of the Great Parthenon that exists. There's some all over the world. Most notably would be the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. Not an exact replica, but you can see the design influences with the fluted columns. But in Philadelphia, there is a bank which was built, which greatly resembles the Parthenon. And I'm going to take a moment and go down a rabbit hole. This really has nothing to do with the sermon itself, but it's very interesting. That bank in Philadelphia was designed by the architect William Strickland, who has a connection to Tennessee because he designed what? Yes, the state capitol. It's not all he designed. He also designed the First Presbyterian Church in Nashville, which is now downtown Presbyterian, with the wonderful Egyptian revival architecture. But coming a little closer to home, what else did he design? In Wilson County, the courthouse, the old Wilson County Courthouse in Lebanon. It burned in 1881. I know some of you are probably married there, but we don't have it around anymore. So Strickland, great American architect, even designed the courthouse here in Lebanon. But getting back to our sermon, of all the replicas, there's one that is, I say, the most infamous of Parthenon replicas, and that is found in Edinburgh, Scotland, and it is called the National Monument of Scotland. And I call it infamous because it was never finished. They started building, and of course, they ran out of money. Now, the reason for this monument was to recognize and honor the soldiers who fought and died in the Napoleonic Wars, which ended in 1815, and that's when Britain and the rest of Europe rose up to fight against Napoleon. And when the war ended, there was a movement throughout Britain to recognize the soldiers who had died by placing monuments in various cities, and Edinburgh was one of these cities. Now, the government wasn't going to pay for any of the monuments because they had used up all their money fighting the war and said any monuments had to be built with private funds. So the leaders of Edinburgh came up with the idea of building a Parthenon because they wanted to recognize Edinburgh as the Athens of the North. There's a theme here. And since the Parthenon in Greece represented the height of Greek culture and philosophy and education and democracy and all those things, they thought it would be fitting to have it there in their city. So they came up with a plan to build a Parthenon on Calton Hill, just north of the city, and they projected the cost would be £42,000. I have no idea how that converts in today's money, but it was a lot. And they went out to raise the money, and they only raised £16,000. But they started building anyway. They figured people would give more money. So they started building in 1826 and continued for 3 years until they completely ran out of funding because people kind of lost interest in the project. And so it stands there today. The original Parthenon has 46 columns. The National Monument in Edinburgh has 12. That's as far as they got. And it stands there today on Carlton Hill. You can go visit it. And the Scots are great at making fun of themselves. And so they have named this place Scotland's Folly or Edinburgh's Disgrace, or my favorite, the Pride and Poverty of Scotland. But I tell this story about this monument because it perfectly illustrates one of the parables that we read today in the Gospel of Luke. And that parable is about building buildings and not finishing them because you don't have enough money. He says in this parable, "For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and estimate the cost to see whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it will begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This fellow began to build and was not able to finish.'" Now, a tower, for the people of the day, would have been a very familiar structure. It's nothing special about it. It's a tower you would build in the middle of a field or an orchard so that you could watch your crop as during the growing season to make sure, you know, there weren't any predators, thieves, or fire, keeping a view on your property and what you were growing. So there were towers everywhere. And so if you needed to build a tower, Jesus says, you know, you're going to sit down and figure out the cost, make sure you have enough money, because you don't want to run out of money partway through the project and have people laugh at you, which is exactly what happened in Scotland. He tells this parable in the context of discipleship. As we read, he's traveling down the road, and there is a large crowd with him. We don't know how many, dozens, hundreds even. Jesus is traveling from village to village, teaching and preaching, and these people are coming along with him. And he says to them, "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself, cannot be my disciple." Well, that must have been distressing because they were following, thinking they were his disciples. We're going to follow this guy from town to town and do what he says. And he's now telling us that we've got to hate our families? That's a lot to swallow there. And then he goes on to say, whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. So now we've upped it just from hating your family and friends to execution. Because although Jesus hadn't been crucified yet, the people would have been very familiar with the imagery of the cross because it was the horrible form of execution used by the Romans. And in fact, many people who were executed who were hung and crucified and hung up there, others would walk by and ridicule them. We see this at Jesus' execution. People mocked him as he died. So Jesus is saying, not only do you have to hate your family, set them aside, you've got to sacrifice your life as well. Because this passage, this very difficult reading, is about discipleship. It's about the cost of following Jesus. And that's why he tells these two parables. He says, because we as human beings, we like to figure out the cost of things. And so he tells the first story about the tower. If you want to build a tower, you're going to figure out the cost. You don't want to run out of money halfway through. And the crowds here, they go, yeah, that makes sense. And then he talks about two kings, which is something the people wouldn't necessarily understand intuitively, but they can see what's going on. He tells a story about a king who's at war with another king. And the first one, as he prepares for war, he sits down and he counts up the cost. How many soldiers have I got? How many soldiers does he have? I've got 10,000. He's got 20. The odds don't look so good, do they? Maybe I shouldn't go to war against this other king because I could lose. And if I lose, I could lose everything. So maybe it's better just to send out a peace delegation to work out some sort of agreement where I might have to give up a little, but I'm not going to lose everything. Again, like building a tower, we sit down and we figure out the cost. You all do this in every aspect of your life. You figure out the risk and the benefits, but mostly the risk. And so he concludes this reading here. He tells the two parables, and he says to the people, so therefore, none of you can become my disciples if you do not give up all your possessions. So now we've got to hate our family. We've got to risk our lives. And we've got to give up everything that we own. This is getting tough. So why is it that those people were following him in the first place? Well, they saw a lot of upside to it. He's been talking about the kingdom. You know, if I follow this guy, he's going to help me improve my relationship with God and maybe get me into that kingdom. That would be great. And he's been doing miracles, hasn't he? If I get sick or I get hurt, he can heal me. Or maybe somebody's got a bad leg and they're going along hoping that they will get cured. And remember, he feeds people too. Feeds 5,000 without a blinking an eye. Wow, get free food along the way. And I'm sure there was some thought about monetary advantages because of Jesus talking about abundance. Wow, if I follow this, my life is going to be great, isn't it? Because he was offering hope at what they might gain. But they weren't taking into account the cost, the total cost of following Jesus, of giving their lives to God. As I said, human beings plan, we budget, we count the cost, we weigh the risk. We don't want to run out before the project is complete. Even in circumstances of love, some people will get a prenuptial agreement, won't they? Because in case that love doesn't work out, they want to protect themselves. We always have a contingency plan. And so in this reading, Jesus says that if we want to follow him, we've got to hate our families. Well, that's strong language, isn't it? I don't want to hate my family. But I don't think he's actually saying that we have to hate our family, no matter how toxic some of our family can be. It's not that we hate them. It's that if we give ourselves completely and wholly to God, if we love God with all of our heart and mind and strength, if we do that, then relatively speaking, the love that we have for those closest to us, our family, which is the greatest love in our life, well, compared to love for God, it's going to look like hatred. I mean, just comparatively speaking, it's still good, but the love for God is so great that anything else is just less than. So it's not that you hate your family, it's that you love God fully in a way that maybe you can't love people. Jesus is saying we must love God so much that any other relationship looks like hate. There's no holding back. We have to give ourselves wholly and completely to God. We must give everything. And he ends, as I said, saying, so therefore none of you can become my disciple if you do not give up and renounce. Give up all your possessions. And so there are two words I want to look at that are important here. The first is give up, a word which is often translated renounce. So you have to give up your possessions. It's not just getting rid of what you have. It means renouncing their importance in your life. These things that I'm taking out of my life have no meaning for me anymore. Jesus is saying that to become his disciple, to be a follower, it is necessary to renounce all that holds us in this world. He's not just saying, you know, give it to Goodwill, but you have to renounce its hold on your life. You have to empty yourself completely. And the second word is possessions. We have to renounce our possessions. And again, possessions are not just the stuff that we have cluttering our house. It also means one means of living. Your possessions are the things that define who you are. It's the stuff that keeps you going. You know, if you're a cowboy, you've got to give up your saddle because your saddle defines you. If you're a violinist, you must give up your violin. If you're a surgeon, you have to give up your hands even. You have to give up everything that defines you in this life and give yourself to God. To be a follower of Christ is to be always ready to say farewell to any person, position, possession that compromises your allegiance to God. That is the cost of discipleship, to give up everything, to renounce everything, to empty yourself. You cannot hold back. We can't come here and just be complacently cultural Christians and call ourselves disciples of Christ. We have to give wholly. We can't write a prenup with God. We can't rely on a safety net or a contingency plan. There's no holding something back here just in case. And if you come here to be challenged, I mean, you need to come here to be challenged and not just to be comfortable. If your goal is to gather in this place on a Sunday to hang out with your friends, hear your favorite songs, then you're in the wrong place. You're not following Christ. You're just walking along beside him, hoping that something good will fall off the table. To be a disciple of Christ is to give ourselves fully. As the commandment says, we are to love God with all our heart, all our soul, all our strength, and all our mind, and hold nothing back. Amen.